I want to talk about Christian callings and just the Bible language. Their calling is used in two senses in the New Testament. There is the calling that all Christians share together to follow Jesus Christ. Jesus sees Peter and Andrew mending the nets and says, "Come and follow me." That's our calling. In Ephesians, Paul says, "I call you, brethren, to live worthy of the high calling that you have in Jesus Christ." And then there is a second sense of calling, which you might call providential calling. And that is our status in life. We use the word in the Latin version, vocation, often to mean the way in which we earn our money. And some people also take that in a strong or a weak sense. Strong sense, God called me to be a teacher. Weak sense, well, I'm a teacher, and I guess that's my vocation. But in both cases, we have the language there. 1 Corinthians chapter 7 indicates that each Christian, in whatever calling they find themselves providentially, should there serve God with a good conscience. Nevertheless, some callings are better than others. So, for example, he says, if you are called a slave, do not worry. But if you get a chance for freedom, take it. Now, there are two common callings that I want to talk about, and that's a calling to be a husband and a calling to be a wife. To those of you who are already married, you are called to be married. And the proof is, you are married. God in His providence arranged it that you are married, that's your calling, and you're stuck with it. If you are not married, that's what I want to talk about at this point. Or you're widowed. Unmarried or widowed, the opportunity, the gift, the choice may or may not arrive. What about the calling of being husband or wife in a society which both highly values it and highly undervalues it at the same time? Now, the first thing I want to notice about a husband-wife calling is that this calling comes in pairs. We have other examples of such callings in pairs. The outward and inward call to the ministry is a calling in pairs. That is, a man can say, "I am called to be a pastor," and never find a church that thinks he's the right one for them, and so never end up being a pastor. So you have a call from a congregation to be pastor, and you have a man with an inward call from God he thinks to be pastor. And when you have both those together, then you have a relationship between a pastor and a congregation. Likewise, employee and employer. Imagine you go to a company and you say, "God has called me to work here." And the employer says, "No, he hasn't, because I don't want you." And, that's the end of the issue. And it works the other way also. The employer can say, "I want to recruit you." And you say, "Well, I don't want to work for you." End of matter. It's a paired calling. Now, you'll maybe pick up, I'm speaking like a Presbyterian here. Presbyterians do free, if you are free mutual choice. If you're in the Episcopal Church, the congregation doesn't call the pastor. The bishop calls the pastor. There's still two people thinking there's a call. There's the priest, and then there's the bishop. And the bishop says, "God's call on you is to go be rector of this congregation." And you say, "I accept that, and I accept the call." So there's still a mutual thing, but it's not between pastor and congregation, between bishop and young priest. It gets a little more problematic with slave labor. That's you hardly quite say, "I think God has called me to be your slave." Nobody ever said that. And maybe that's why the scriptures say if you're a slave and you can get out of it. Marriages have often been arranged. When we lived in Cyprus, there were four ways marriages got contracted, basically. There was the ultra-conservative. The parents would arrange it. End of matter. There was the conservative. Parents would arrange. Children get veto power. There was the semi-Western. Children arrange. Parents get veto power. And then there was the Western pattern. Children choose. All right, the Presbyterian way is children choose. All right, that's and actually that's been the Christian way for a long time. There was a long battle between the church and parents as to who controlled marriage. And the church always said it's up to the children to choose to marry. And if they choose to marry, we'll perform the ceremony. And you can see this echoed, for example, as just this is how things are in Romeo and Juliet. Would those families have approved Romeo and Juliet marriage? No way in Shakespeare's play. But they can find a priest to marry them. Juliet's 14. She's old enough. I think Romeo is about 17. So the church will marry him. Robin Hood, earlier English story. You have Friar Tuck. He's ready to marry him. The fact that there are obstacles, the church is not looking at parental obstacles as genuine obstacles often. So the church's view has been the children choose. Mutual calling. To enter a marriage, sooner or later, somebody has to say to somebody else, will you marry me? Right, that is the key question. Will you marry me? I heard a wonderful account of a marriage proposal from a few days ago at the Geneva College reunion of the singing group, the New Song Group that goes around the country. And in the middle of the reunion, some guy said, I have played the role of Jacob marrying Leah and marrying Rachel in 30 different states. But I don't love Leah and I don't want to marry Rachel. And then he got down his knees and he says, I want to marry you, Lydia. It's a good proposal. Will you marry me? Now, the cultural norm in our day is it's the man's job to say to the woman, will you marry me? All right, that's our cultural norm. It's the man's job. And the woman's job is to hang around looking ready. Right? That's her job. She's supposed to indicate, if she's interested in her marriage, she's supposed to indicate, in, you know, whatever clever way she can say it, without quite saying, if you ask me, I will say yes. Right? You're not, that's going just a step too far. But it's up to the guy. We had a couple in our family, or in our church, years and years ago now, and they had been a couple in college, and then after a year of going different ways after college, she had moved to our area to be close to him, and they are still a couple, and 7 years had gone by since they first met each other. And so finally, I called the guy over to my house, and I said to him, are you going to marry her? He was equivocal. I said, you have to. He looked at me a little strangely. I said, look, she's been hanging around for 7 years waiting for you to ask her to marry you. This is so obvious. And you haven't told her to get lost. You owe it to her now. You have to marry her. You go out, you buy a ring. After you buy a ring, you go to her and you say, will you marry me? And she'll say yes. And then you give her the ring and then you'll be married. So 3 weeks later, she showed up at church with the ring. And he'd done what I told him. It's been a happy marriage. I only did that once, but I thought, he needed that last little kick. Earnest Christians are always searching the scriptures for how to make my life more godly/easy. I think we often have the two confused. And so there's been an effort by some writers to find the biblical way to do all this and get a man and a woman together. All right, it's my job this morning to tell you that all those books are smoking something. There is no biblical way to do this. There is no biblical way to do this. Now, why do I say this? There should be, shouldn't there? But I don't think there is. If you go through the Bible, you've got a number of examples of man and woman getting together. There is no pattern whatsoever. The biblical way is you go to sleep, God takes out a rib and makes you a wife. That's how it was done in the beginning. Men, you could just lie around, go to sleep, and wait for that to happen to you. That is the biblical way. Or perhaps the biblical way is wait until some woman is trying to get water for her sheep. and then go right up there and take the lid off the well, water the sheep for her, and she will fall for you every time. All right. Well, the biblical way is, wait till some woman's got a flock of sheep at a well, and there are some really nasty men shepherds around pushing them around, and you go and you beat up those men shepherds, and then water the flock, and then she goes home, and her father says, why are you home so fast? And you say, well, some Egyptian came and helped us and beat up the nasty men shepherds, and the father says, why didn't you invite him home for supper? And you go out and get him, and then you marry one of them. That's the biblical way. There is only one book of the Bible devoted entirely to how a man and a woman got married. Do you know which book that is? Book of Ruth. All right, I'm going to give you the book of Ruth right now. This is the book of the Bible devoted entirely to how a man and a woman got together. This surely must be the biblical way because there's a whole book devoted to it. All right, here's the story. There was a man and a woman from Bethlehem, and in a famine they left. They went to Moab. The two sons that they had got married. Then the father died. Then the two sons died. And you're left with widowed mother, widowed daughter-in-law, and widowed daughter-in-law. And then the famine ends in Bethlehem, so they decide to go back to Bethlehem. On the way back, one daughter-in-law says, I'm not coming with you. Actually, the mother-in-law sends her home. And so she comes back with one daughter. And this is Naomi, the mother-in-law, and Ruth, the daughter-in-law. And then, now that they're back, they've got no food. But it's the beginning of barley season, which means it's probably late April, early May in that part of the world. And Ruth, with a lot of initiative, says to her mother-in-law, can I go out and glean in the fields, legally allowed? You can pick up the wheat or the barley left behind by the reapers. So she happens to go to the field of Boaz. Boaz is a rich man. Boaz is an older man, and Boaz has no wife. Ruth doesn't know any of this. She just happens to go in that field. Boaz comes by and he says, who's that woman over there? And they say, oh, that is Ruth, the daughter-in-law of Naomi. Boaz says, will you come close? You can drink our water. I'll give you food. The servants wink at each other. The Bible doesn't say that. That's what happened, though. All right. And then at the end of the day, Boaz says to her, you come back here. So she goes home, and her mother-in-law says, where did you get all that grain? And she says, I happened on the field of Boaz. And her mother-in-law goes, bing! That's a close relative. You keep going there. So Ruth goes back there, and then it's harvest time. And Boaz just is not moving into action. He's the close relative. He doesn't do anything. He just favors Ruth. She follows the barley harvest, does the wheat harvest. It comes to the end, and then it's time to do the threshing. So Naomi says to Ruth, and now, you know, this is the Bible, guys. Naomi says to Ruth, wash yourself, put on your best clothes, put on your perfume, go to the threshing floor, and when it's dark, lie down at the feet of Boaz, and when he wakes up in the middle of the night, and he notices there's a woman right there, then he'll do the right thing. So Ruth follows her mother-in-law's advice, and she's there in the dark. And you know, it's really dark in those days because it's dark. And Boaz wakes up in the middle of the night, and you know, his feet touch something, and he says, "Who are you?" And she says, "I am Ruth." And then she goes to her mother-in-law one better. What does Ruth do at that point? Do you know the story? She says, "Will you marry me?" She does it a little bit poetically, but she says, will you marry me? She says, will you take the edge of your cloak and put it over your handmaiden or something along those lines? And the meaning is unmistakable. And he says to her, you keep quiet. You leave before it's light so nobody will know you're here. But they told the story later because we know it. You know, lots of parents like to tell their children how they actually got together, and it doesn't follow any pattern I know. I'm going to tell you a whole bunch of stories later in a minute. So I'm going to finish Ruth. So Ruth goes home, and she's loaded down with grain that Boaz has given her, and her mother-in-law, who has not slept a wink all night, because there's a lot at stake here, she says, how did it go? Ruth tells her the whole story. Mother-in-law, who understands men, says, don't worry. He will not rest until he has finished this off today. Sure enough, Boaz goes and sits in the gate when you carry out business, waits till a closer relative comes by. He says, come over here, close relative of Naomi. He comes over and sits down. You got your witnesses around. Boaz says, now you have a right to redeem the property of our relative Elimelech. And he says, okay, good, I'd like to do that. And then Boaz springs the trap. And by the way, you get Ruth along with the land. That's the deal. And he says, well, I don't want Ruth. Boaz says, okay, I get her. And they're married. All right, that's the biblical pattern. Ruth says to Boaz, will you marry me? He needs a kick. She provides it. All right, stories. Young couple in our church. She has moved to be close. They haven't quite actually made the necessary connection to be a couple because they're both shy. So we're down at Ocean City in New Jersey for our annual church picnic. He's out in the water. Older woman goes to the younger woman and says, do you see him out there in the waves? Go out, stand next to him, and take his hand in yours. So she obediently listens to the woman who's twice her age. She walks out into the water. She goes up to the young man. She reaches out. She takes his hand in hers. And they are a couple thereafter. And a year later, they're married. They're still married. They have children. They are happy. All right. Is that the biblical method? All right. Different story. This is my family. Daughter is physics major studying get a PhD in engineering at University of Pennsylvania. And I think to myself, who is she going to marry? Fathers worry about this. So do mothers. So that's my worry. So she's at the International RP Convention, and my wife and I didn't go that summer. And we hear back around that daughter was seen talking to this young man. That's all we hear. All right, but we know young man's name. We know what congregation young man is from. Nothing happens through August and September. I get on the phone to young man's pastor. I say, do you know young man? He says, yes, I do. I said, what do you think about him? He's a good guy. What's he studying? He's a physics major at University of Chicago. I go, physics major at University of Chicago? And my daughter was talking to him. I said, take him out and tell him to write my daughter. So he takes young man out for dinner and says, I understand you were talking to Betsy Edgar. I'll give you my username. You probably know these people. You're talking to Betsy Edgar. Have you followed up on that? No, because he's kind of shy. Well, why don't you write her a letter? So he gives him a kick. So he writes her a letter. Letter arrives in our house. Oh my goodness. Smiles. Happiness. Delight. They carry on a torrid romance by email. Thousands of pages. Sharing their lives and physics jokes together. The story about the younger brothers in our family was, do not be between Betsy and the front door and the stairs when she comes home from Penn, because she will run you over on her way to the computer to read the latest emails. All right, so he moves to our area. They're married. They have four children. They're happy. He comes to me and says, the pro forma, may I marry your daughter, after they had seen each other face to face for precisely 6 days. They'd shared a lot of emails. Frankly, if I hadn't lived in the Middle East and seen that arranged marriages actually work as well as our choosing method, I might have been a little uneasy. Instead, since I'd had a little hand in arranging this, I said, oh, absolutely. How many of you have read the autobiography of John G. Payton? All right, got a couple of hands here. I meant to bring my copy with me. He has the most delightful account of how his parents met. And it's an account that was obviously told to their large family over and over again. Right? And so here is, I don't have it to read, so I can't reproduce his fun way of turn a phrase on this. All right, here we are in Scotland, mid-19th century, American ideal of Christian utopia. All right, so John G. Payton has a sound conversion when he's about 17 or 18 and spends a good part of every midday in earnest prayer. And so he would go to a secluded spot, take off his hat, and pray. Young woman gets sent to the household of her uncle, who is wonderfully named Adam. And so she's there taking care of him for the summer. And she's out wandering on his property, notices young man at prayer, and steals his hat. He comes out of his prayer, hat is missing, and in his spiritual reverie concludes on that it must have been an angel that took it. Comes back next day with new hat. Hangs it up. She comes by and steals hat number two. And then on the third day, her conscience bothers her. So she writes a note to young man. And the note goes, "She who has stolen your hat feels ashamed of herself and hopes that someday she may be as good a Christian as you are." Pins note to hat in prayer place and then goes off to watch. Young man comes back, retrieves hat, reads note, looks up, sees girl, and knows she is the angel. And then he prays. And the joke is, his prayers were probably had a new theme to them from what they'd had before. So they marry, and they tease each other the rest of their lives about how they met. And she says, "Well, if you are going to insist on going into the Garden of Adam, you will have to deal with the Eve who comes by." Is that the biblical way? You know, the book of Proverbs, Solomon says, there are three things, yea, four, which are too marvelous for me. I don't understand how they work. And he has three or four animal examples. And the last one is the way of a man with a maid, which is actually the point of his comparisons. I do not understand the way of a man with a maid. And I first became aware of that proverb in a high school sociology class. We had this really dopey textbook in which the introduction said there are some things people didn't understand before, but now through the greatness of sociology, we now understand them. And then it quotes that verse and indicates that thanks to sociology, we now understand the way of a man with a maid. And as I read this as a high school student, I was offended that the book had such chutzpah as to claim that it understood what Solomon didn't understand. And I've had the same reaction to purported Christian writers ever since, who say to earnest Christian parents, "Here is the right biblical way for your daughter or your son to meet somebody to marry." And then I've read some of these recently, and I said, "What are they thinking? What are they thinking? They're putting one barrier after another between men and women to make it harder and harder for them to get together in a society where the marriage rate is falling. It's hard enough right now for men and women to get together without having a whole other new bunch of procedures and rules and regulations handed on to them by some purported Christian authority." I read a book by Josh Harris, "I Kissed Gating Goodbye." It's been very popular. Okay, now this is a book written by a young guy who's a cad, who has broken one girl's heart after another, and he repents. That's fine. Then he writes a book telling everybody else how they ought to do it, but he hasn't done it yet himself. And then I read a follow-up book. He didn't do his own advice when he got married. And people are earnestly taking this book and taking it to heart and not getting married. If a son were to now come to me, and I've got two unmarried sons, and say, "I met a good, great girl. She said that her family believes in courtship marriage. I want to tell you what I would say to my son. Go find another woman." I'm quite serious. I would say, go find another woman. They're going to put so many barriers and obstacles in your way that with all kinds of purported holiness and piety and everything else, with all kinds of biblical front around this, biblical that, and they're just making it up. They're making up a social custom that doesn't exist in this country. If it ever did, it existed in upper-class New York City society between the Civil War and World War I. I can tell you where it existed. That's where it was. I don't know why we want to imitate in the Christian community New York upper-class society between the Civil War and World War I. It fell apart. There is Bill Gothard advice. There is American Vision advice. If you come across those books, my advice is wastebasket. At least on the subject of marriage and how to get married. So, here's what I have to say. There is no biblical way, except maybe the Book of Ruth's way, for husband and wife or man and woman to get together. The way of a man with a maid is too much for Solomon to understand how that works. And if one of the fun things that couples do when they get together is, how did you meet your wife? How did you meet your husband? How did you get together? You know why this is fun? There is no pattern. There is no pattern. You go, I bet we went through every married couple here and we said, how did you get together? You've each got your own somewhat off-kilter account. Here's my off-kilter account. I met my wife through my brother. Said to my brother, is she your girlfriend? He said, no. I said, fair game. What he meant was, no, but I wish she were. But he didn't say the last part. But then I was a little too shy to go anywhere. So her cousin in town, in Swarthmore, wiser, older woman, gives to her two tickets to the Philadelphia Symphony Orchestra. So she comes to me and she says, do you know anybody who would like to go to the symphony orchestra? I have two tickets. At this point, knowing that my brother's answer was no, but I wish she were, I said, well, maybe my brother. And she said, no, I meant you. Kind of close to Ruth, isn't it? That wasn't the marriage proposal. I did it properly. I said, will you marry me? And enough about this, how husbands and wives get together. I urge you, don't put so-called biblical rules and requirements on your children when it comes to this. Marriage, I want to talk about being married. It's tough. Being married is tough. Because as soon as you're married, you are now yoked to this other person who will cross your will for the rest of your life over and over again. You marry them hoping to be happy, hoping they will make you happy, and you are no sooner married than you discover they cross your will way more than your father and mother ever did, because they are more present to you than your father and mother could possibly have been. Jesus does not allow second thoughts. His disciples say, well, why would anybody get married then? But Jesus does not allow second thoughts. You marry until death do us part. Marriage vows in the English language world are quite realistic. Quite realistic. And they point out to the new couple all the dangers. It may be for poverty. And you may together share poverty for 50 years. It may be for sickness. And you end up being the nurse to the other one, and there's not much mutual benefit. All the work goes on one. Good friend of ours just died, Christian Ajemian. And after they had been Christian for about 6 or 7 years, she, the wife, Laura, contracted, what's the disease you're tired all the time? Chronic fatigue syndrome, that's it. Chronic fatigue syndrome. And for about 10 to 12 years, he did everything in the house. He raised the children. He did the meals. He did the cooking. He did the laundry. He did the work. He earned the money. He did everything because she was flat on her back for 10 to 12 years. Meanwhile, he researched every possible avenue to find medical help for her. And they ended up in Boston, finally found a program that fit what she needed. And she recovered about 60% of her former strength. And about 2 years later, he came down with Lou Gehrig's disease, and then she nursed him until his death about a month ago. That's marriage. Loyalty. And we say that when we marry, don't we? For sickness, in sickness, and in health. And we don't intend the sickness, of course. We anticipate health. But sometimes God's providence is different. This is a hard calling. I always tell couples when I do pre-marriage counseling. By the way, pre-marriage counseling is fun. I enjoy it. Post-marriage counseling is not fun. Very necessary, but not fun. Pre-marriage counseling. I always tell the new couple, I always begin with this question. So why do you want to get married? And first they look at me like I'm really stupid. Right? And then they look fondly at each other and they say, because we love each other. And then we go from there and I say, that's a stupid reason to get married. Right. And we go into the confession of faith reasons for marriage. What? Mutual benefit for the bearing of children. And then in this wonderful phrase in the confession of faith, and for the prevention of uncleanness. All right. Those are the three purposes given for marriage in the confession of faith. But, you know, when you are looking towards marriage, each partner is on their good behavior mostly. And so I always say, you won't really know whom you've married until you've been married for about 2 years. Then you'll know what you've got. That's a scary thought, isn't it? And the American approach in which we choose, the point is we're looking over all the possibilities and we choose out the best one and we say, will you marry me? You are the best of all possible people I could ask. And I don't think anybody else would ever say yes, but we don't add that part. All right, so we make our proposal and we think we've chosen wisely. You know, in the arranged marriage world, it turns out the parents think they know human character way better than 19-year-olds and 22-year-olds. And they say to their kids, we're a lot better equipped to choose who you marry than you are, and so we're choosing. And again, from what I saw in Cyprus, there's a lot to be said for that. It was amazing to me as a teacher over the years. By the time I was done teaching, I dealt with about 3,000 people in my classroom. That's a rough number. Do you know how after you've dealt with 3,000 people, you begin to see things? Teachers get together, we'd sort of laugh about our students. They think we don't understand them. We understand them so much more than they imagine. They would be embarrassed as to how well we understood them. Teachers actually pay attention to who's going with whom. Common theme. Why is she going with that loser? Right. A common theme among the teachers. It's just perplexed at what is in a girl's mind at 16 or 17. She's going with that loser. Anyway, girls like a lot of girls like losers. So you marry. And then after 2 or 3 years, you may discover the person you married is not fully formed Christian character. Then what? Well, then you have to deal with that. In fact, sometimes when you marry, you're worse off than if you're not married. And the wedding vows sort of indicate that. How about if it's for both poverty and sickness and bad temper? And there are two great dangers in marriage. One is that the other one will be unfaithful. Still a deal breaker in our society for many, many people. And a source of immense heartache for both the couple and the children if they have some. The other danger is, it's almost guaranteed that one of you will be left a widow. It's guaranteed. One of you will be left a widow. And the person that you have relied on and lived with and shared everything with for 30, 40, 50, 60 years will be gone. And you won't see them again in this life, and you'll be a widow. As couples get older, they start talking with each other. Now, I think the theme of what a lot of them think is I die first. No, I get to die first. No, I die first. My wife says to me, God hears you. Every time you say you die first, he's going to make you live longer. All And then there's the danger that the person you marry in good faith as a fellow believer renounces the faith. I've seen that happen. And you did all due diligence, asked the faith of the other person, and they turn out for whatever reason to have been insincere and turn away from the Lord. There are great dangers. Another difficulty with marriage. Did you expect to hear a talk on the difficulties of marriage now? Anyway, another difficulty with marriage. There's a structure to marriage that is contrary to our natural sinful natures. There is a God-given structure to marriage that is contrary to our natural sinful sinful tendencies. Paul in Ephesians sets out some of the structure. Wives subject to their husbands. I think the wife, by the way, usually feels the load of her position in the marriage more heavily than the husband does, although I think it should be the other way around. There's a temptation to refuse and rebel in every proud human. Many countries have conflated the biblical word be subject to with another word, obey. Totally different words in the Greek with quite different flavors to them. And so there's been an awful lot of bad teaching about wife that indicates just obey. I think that's false. I don't have to go into it right now. I don't have time. And I think often in marriages, wives are more dependent emotionally on their man's approval and support than the other way around. And I think you can go back to Genesis 3:16 and see something of this. Her desire will be to him and he will rule over her. So that, typically if you ask a husband and wife, so how's your marriage going? On a scale of 1 to 5, how's it going? If the man answers 4, what's the woman going to say? 3. If the man says 3, what's the woman going to say? 2. If the man says 5, what's the woman going to say? 1. He's deluded. The structure for the husband is, he is to love his wife like Christ loves the church and as he loves himself. And for most men, there's a limited version of this sacrifice. Work hard, but listen patiently. And sometimes men read the word head as though it means command or final word. Again, I think a mistaken reading of that word, but no time to develop that right now. Finally, I don't want to discourage you. It is a rewarding calling. You have a companion in your walk with God and the greatest help to your sanctification that you could have. Who knows your faults better than your husband or wife? Typical husband complaint, my wife doesn't understand me. Actual reality, my wife understands me all too well. You have a companion in trouble, a companion in the joys, a companion in the sorrows of life. Ecclesiastes 4, 2 are better than 1, and describes friendship fits for Ecclesiastes chapter 4, but a husband and wife fit, I think, even more tightly. If one falls, the other is there to pick him up. If one's in trouble, the other one will protect him. You know, the law of Moses assumes that if a man is in a fight with another man and getting the worst of it, the losing man's wife will come in and help him. And it just sets some limits on what she can do. One of my favorite movie scenes is wife helping husband in High Noon. Grace Kelly from Philadelphia. Grace Kelly plays the new Quaker wife of the outgoing sheriff. And bad guys whom he has put in prison are coming back to town on the 12 noon local. And everybody in town is afraid of these guys. And so Sheriff decides to stay around. It's Gary Cooper, right? Yeah, Gary Cooper. What a man. Gary Cooper, he hangs around. And the men all are not going to support him. So he's left alone to face the 3 or 4, I think it's 3, bad men as they ride into town. And they have a running gun battle through town. And he kills the one, and he has a fight with the other and kills him. And then there's one more still hunting him. And the scene is he's finally got the drop on Gary Cooper. And Grace Kelly, looking out the window, Quaker that she is, with loaded gun in her hand, looks at her husband, her new husband, about to be shot. And she pulls the trigger and saves her husband. Husband and wife. Men, you should have a wife who will pull the trigger for you and shoot that guy. There's the blessing of conjugal love, the desire for which God has built into us to nudge us towards marriage and towards children. There's the blessing of mutual help regarding division of labor. You know, division of labor is always more fruitful than everybody doing everything. In my family, we've had an extreme division of labor because for years I did two jobs. And people would say to me, well, how do you teach school full time and how do you also pastor a church? Right? And I had several pieces of my answer, but one part of my answer was, my wife does everything else. The family works, she does everything else. I helped out with taking care of the children, and that was about it. If a doorknob needed repairing, she repaired it. She did everything else. That's how it worked. And finally, children. The Bible is consistent in saying children are a blessing from the Lord. If you have your quiver full of them, how blessed you are. You can face down your enemies in the gate and you won't be afraid. My son Alex bought a duplex about 3 years ago, and he was in the upstairs was empty. The downstairs had a renter already by the name of Bill. Bill turned out to be a real, real ornery character. And we checked around. Even the guys who were his buddies in the local volunteer fire company couldn't stand this guy. And Alex was stuck with him downstairs. He hadn't paid his rent for 4 months. And he was basically saying, make me. And he was just a nasty character. So as we're moving Alex in, and I've already known all of this about Alex. Alex is our third child, second son. This guy looked out in the street, and he looked sort of like Alex's description of Bill. I said, who's that? He said, that's Bill. So I went right down the stairs and went over to Bill. I said, hi. Your name, Bill? Yes. You live downstairs here? Yes. Hi. I'm the father of Alex, who just bought the apartment upstairs. I just wanted to say hi to you. And that guy over there who's helping carry stuff in, that's his brother, Adam. And I don't want you to be upset or concerned if you see another guy who might be helping soon. That's his older brother, John, who might be with his brother-in-law, Duren. They're both kind of big guys. And then there's, but don't be concerned. And then there's another younger brother not here today. He might help out. His name is Daniel. Now, if that has kind of a mafia sound to it, it was supposed to. I am from Philadelphia. I'm actually in Southeast Delco, which is just South Philly extended, if you know our geography. A couple of weeks later, my wife gets a call from Alex. He's gone. He's gone. My wife says, what? What happened? What happened? He's gone. Who's gone? Bill's gone. I don't know where he went. Is this good? Yes! I was out walking. We have a cabin up in the Catskills. And I'm out walking with two of the boys along the stream. And we crossed over the border from our land to the next land. None of it's farmed. Everybody just walks all over everybody else's land, looking at the flora and fauna. And so we're over there. And a guy comes up the creek in a rowboat. All right, so here I am, me with two sons. He's in the rowboat. And he looks up and he says, you know you're trespassing? I said, yeah. He says, you know, I'm a lawyer from New York. I said, good. I said, do you know the bridge over the stream further on up? He says, yes. I said, ever use it? He says, oh, yeah, often. I said, I own the bridge. He says, oh. I said, would you like to start this conversation over again? And I'm all the time thinking, what is the matter with this man? We're in the middle of nowhere. Here I am on the high ground. There's stones all around. I got two boys next to me. He is dead meat if we decide to pick up the stones. This is not New York City courtroom. Children are a blessing. I'm just reproducing the spirit of Psalm 127. You meet your enemies in the gate, you aren't afraid. And you know, as you get old, if your children follow in your faith, you become stronger. You become stronger. Your body weakens, but your knowledge of your place in the world and before God becomes stronger. Children bring you strength and comfort in your old age. Only men and women can produce children. Lots of people in our society wish it were not so and try to come up with almost evasions of it. But you know, with artificial insemination, it is still man and woman. You've got to do that to have children. Cloning is not going to work. Stable father-mother family are the best context in which to raise children to serve God and benefit society. Children are best raised in father-mother families where the father is firm enough that it is advisable for the children to behave, wise enough that it is reasonable for the children to behave, and loving enough that it is a joy for the children to behave. And children are best raised in a father-mother family where the mother is firm enough that it is advisable to obey and wise enough that it is reasonable to obey and loving enough that it is a pleasure to obey. And where father and mother are so visibly loyal to each other that the security of home is just an unquestioned good reality in the lives of our children. Nothing else begins to measure up to that. What is marriage? Marriage is a covenant of lifelong fidelity between a man and a woman to live as one flesh for their mutual help and for the bearing of children. It is the first husband-wife, is the first human institution that God ordained, and it is before the fall. This is not something that comes after the fall like the state or the church, actually. This is before the fall. Most people are called to marry. If you are not called to marry, do not worry about it. The eternal state will not involve marriage. We are only married until death do us part. There's a good story of an old covenanter minister in Scotland in the 1670s, known for his piety, and on his deathbed has his family and his wife and his church gathered around him as he prays for them all in order. And he prays first for his church, and then he prays for his children, and then he prays last of all for his wife, who is no longer my wife. And those are his last words as he dies. Seems a little rough to me, but the theology's right. She's now a widow and free to marry again. So marriage is not eternal. And if you're not called to marriage, do not worry about it. God has other ways for you to serve him in this world. I thank God for my unmarried aunt who took her widowed sister, three sons, raised us as hers. So if God doesn't call you to marriage, do not worry. There are other avenues of service. I weep over our country throwing away so many good things that we inherited. I don't relish a fight. But if we meekly give way and allow marriage and friendship to be conflated into a single idea with sex attached to it, all will be the losers. Friends will be the losers, children will be the losers, husbands and wives will be the losers, and the whole society will be the loser. It is not a pleasant thing to look forward to. I was talking to somebody here who's in college, and I said, my time is not too much more. And on this issue, I get a pass. I get a pass because I'm old. And people say, well, you're old, you're set in your ways, and we can forgive you for your opinions, backward and bigoted as they may be. But for my children and for you who are younger, it is a more pressing issue. You won't get a pass from those who, with all the moral righteous fervor that they have, insist that the laws and the customs be changed to suit their preference. And if you oppose it, you will not get a pass. You will pay a price. If you do not pay the price, and I mean you in the large sense, the next generation, if you do not pay the price, then you will suffer, your children will suffer, and the society will not be blessed. That is our sad situation. And the church needs to get clear what we understand about marriage. Hence, here's a catechism question to memorize. And you can use bits and pieces of it as you think clearly and talk with people. What do you call your acquaintances where it's two men together and two women? There's a perfectly good thing to call them. They're friends. They may insist that you call them spouses. I think Christians had better insist that we call them friends. That will mean conflict. But what did Jesus promise in this world, if not conflict? And how wrong-headed and cowardly to flee conflict when it comes our way in our day. And just in the church, keep repeating the victories of previous generations which had courage to fight their battles. Let me end in prayer. Father in heaven, we thank you for your goodness to us in making us male and female. And we thank you for the blessings of all of the marriages here represented and the children that you've given to many of these marriages. And Lord, I pray for this country that you will send strong leaders to stand in the breach and to courageously and yet with care and with understanding teach those things that you have given to us in your scriptures, that we obey the command of Jesus that we should teach all the things that you commanded us. Bless this congregation. Bless us the rest of this day as we enjoy the beautiful weather that you've given us. And this we pray in Christ's name. Amen. Yeah. Are you willing to Xerox these three sheets for people?
Sure.
All right.
You want to tell me what they are?
Yeah. This is not the talk that you heard. This is the talk you might have heard. This is a put together by my son-in-law, Duren Perkins, based on about a 50-page monograph by Robert P. George, a philosopher at Princeton University who has written cogently from a natural law perspective on marriage. And this is an excellent summary at a level that high school graduates can grasp. George's writing is not easy reading. It's not supposed to be. He's writing for the philosophers on purpose. If you want to follow up his name, you can just Google it and you can find a lot of good things that he's written. I came across his name because first in my college alumni magazine, because he's a graduate of Swarthmore College, so then I followed up on him and said this man's writing is extremely valuable for us in our day. So Robert P. George is the guy. This is a 3-page summary in really tiny font of essentially his argument. And I think you'd find it a very useful summary. I'll take a few questions if anybody has a question or two. Yes. I'm going to come down there. Ever see an old couple walking down the street hand in hand? That's how. When husbands and wives live together in peace and harmony, and you bring people into your homes and they see it, and they don't have the same thing, they will want that. Now, they may not know that that's Christ in the church. I have a brother, one brother who is faithful to the Lord, one who's denied the Lord. He's married to a wife who's read every feminist book that was written by the time they got married. They divide all chores evenly. He does half the cooking, she does half the cooking. He does half the wash, she does half the wash, et cetera, et cetera. He was an economics major, so I said, this is crazy. Economically, there's no division of labor in this. Years ago, they were visiting us. We've made our efforts to stay good friends. They were visiting us, and the wife said to my wife, I want what you have. And my brother, unfortunately, intervened at that point and said, well, you can't have it. Because he understood it goes back to Christ and the church. Now, my wife's regretted since then not contradicting him and saying, he's wrong, yes, you can. But that was the reaction that we can look for. Sometimes they'll say it out loud like that. A lot of times they won't. So hospitality, that's when people actually see your house. And if it's a place of strife, then Christ is not recommended. But if it's a place of peace and harmony, cooperation, it will feel different from what most others will have seen and experienced. Beginning with unsaved relatives. I always start in Jerusalem. Yes?
How would you address, I've seen this on a bulletin board before, how would you address people who would say, who appointed a king in the Old Testament and say, okay, well, and many wives, how can I talk to you about it?
Okay. I didn't get into the marriage but done wrong. All right. I would put polygamy in, genuine marriage, but not according to God's original good plan. And when you go through the Old Testament, there is not a single example of a polygamous marriage that is not portrayed as leading to domestic strife. Furthermore, if you had enough time, I think to polygamy also applies Jesus' word about the law and Moses concerning divorce. For the hardness of your hearts, God allowed this, but it was not so in the beginning. And if you go back to the beginning, he then says, but God created them male and female, and it's just one man for one woman and for life. That's what Jesus says. So that's what I would say, is the Old Testament does portray sinful behavior, sometimes that God has not directly rebuked at that time, yet in his word, there is a rebuke all the way back there in the beginning in Genesis. And it actually became a comp. This is a little bit off the further off on a tangent, but it's worth pointing out. It was a commonplace of Christian political writing from Augustine through Aquinas through Calvin, back when Christians still wrote about society as a whole. Reformed theology has just abandoned that topic for the last three centuries. It's too bad. It was a commonplace that a Christian king will indeed take the law of God into account when he makes his laws, but he must not make the laws too far out of line with the customs and practices of the people that he rules. The point is, if you've got people with a bunch of corrupt customs, you cannot, by force of law, correct all of their evil behavior without becoming a tyrant. And so they would say, wise rulers who are Christians will tailor their law to the customs and practices of their people, push them, you might say, in a godly direction, but to try to do it all at once is simply to become tyrannical. And that is not the role of a Christian leader. And I think the same might be said then about the Old Testament. God is patient, takes a civilization which had in many ways adopted some evil customs, and corrected some things then and some things as time went on. The high places, the high places are tolerated all the way till Josiah's time. God always says they shouldn't be there. Worship should be at the place I appointed here in Jerusalem. And you have good kings saying he was a good king, and then nevertheless he didn't deal with the high places. And so you've got a number of things like that. So that's what I would say about polygamy. I'd also say, of course, that God has arranged things that unless we intervene, the ratio of boys to girls by birth is pretty close to 1-to-1, which points towards either one man, one woman, or strong men get a bunch of wives and a lot of weak men get no wives, which has its own social problems. By the way, I think our society is moving towards polygamy for strong men. As more and more men don't get an education allowing them to support a family, and so they don't marry, and as more and more jobs get exported to countries where labor is cheaper, so you can't have a good job in a factory that supports a family wage, then you have more and more men who can't earn enough money to support a family, and so women will, I think, naturally begin to gravitate towards strong men with enough money to support them, and rather be wife number two with strong man who'll treat me right than wife number one with man who can't do anything. So I think our society is, I don't mean next year or even next decade, but I think we're laying the groundwork at the moment with just free choice, whatever you want as an adult. We're paving the way ideologically for polygamy to reappear in this country. You know, the Republican Party was founded on two principles, anti-slave and anti-polygamy in Utah. If you go back to 1850, the Republican Party, those are the two things it stood for. So we won a battle on polygamy in this country back when Utah, the Mormons were forced to renounce polygamy to come into the Union. But I think, HBO has a show, don't they, on Big Love or something? Don't you love the title? I got that word love in there. Big Love. Guy with three or four wives. Yes. Interesting question. Long answer. My children now, I'll tell you one thing. When I approached 35, I became vividly aware that was the age my father had died. And I became very sad on his account that he never got to see us grow up, marry, right? He just didn't get to see that. And it just overwhelmed my thinking as I approached 35. This was the age at which my father lost his wife and his family young. And so I kept talking about it. The result was my poor oldest son, 9 years old, began imagining his father dying, me. And when I found him sobbing one night as he imagined this possibility, I said, "Oh, shut your mouth, Bill." Or my wife had already said this to me, but I hadn't listened to her. So this is a way in which that sorrow became inflicted on my children. Now, I did it. If I'd been wiser and more self-controlled, I wouldn't have. And I have found at each of the turning points in my children's lives, I have felt acutely again the loss of my father. I might go several years and not think about it, but when my oldest got married and my next one got married, I thought, my father did not get to see this. The second is most people sort of, as a default mode without thinking about it, they raise their kids the way they were raised, unless they have significantly said, I won't do it that way. So up to age 6, I raised my kids the way my father raised us. I could recognize lots of things that I did, same way my father did. After that, I was on my own. All right, so I have the scriptures, I have my father in heaven, I have other men, so I'm not really without resources. My wife and I have recently talked about this. Her parents were divorced in an extremely nasty divorce when she was 11 years old. And then her father remarried and her mother remarried, so that when I met her, she had 2 full brothers, 2 half-sisters, 3 steps on one side, and 2 steps on the other side. And it took me a long time to get that family sorted out, especially since one step was named Lynn and another step was named Lynn. And she would just talk about Lynn, and it took me a while to get straight that there were 2 of these women that were in her family. So we've had to deal also with that sort of family disruption that makes it difficult. So my children have grown up sometimes complaining that they didn't have grandparents. Right? They had my mother, a grandmother, and her mother, Gretchen's mother, died before we got married in a fall, an accident. So we've had a lot of family tragedy. And I can see coming down, my father's mother died when he was 13. And then his father remarried so unhappily that he was raised by an aunt and uncle in Kansas. And my wife's father's father died in a boating accident when he was 17. And then his mother lost all the family wealth, so he was thrown on his own to do everything in his life. And it is true, family tragedies like that bring their own challenges to the next generation, and we face those. It's a reason for us to look more closely at the scriptures, how to do things, and but I can see weaknesses and flaws in our lives that have some roots in the generations before.